I wasn't quite sure what to talk about, you know, for, to a group interested in star formation. I mean, there are lots of there are lots of interesting things that one can say about star formation, but at high redshifts, but almost none of them are going to help us understand star formation. They're mostly, you know, kind of a sort of global bookkeeping and trying to understand, well, where did stars come from that we see in galaxies today? Obviously, we don't have the kind of spatial information that you would need to really understand how the process works. And to a large extent, people who work on high redshift things, star formation happens magically when gas manages to cool from, you know, some temperature that might or might not be the virial temperature of the halo that it's cooling out of. And as soon as it cools, it's called available for star formation. So poof. You know, we don't, generally speaking, we don't observe molecular gas. We're lucky, we have quite a bit of information about H1, but it's not the kind of H1, generally speaking, that's associated with the kinds of star formation regions in nearby galaxies that people might be more familiar with. So having said all of that, I should say that most of what I'm going to talk about actually has to... Wow, I've never seen a spot like that. most of what I'm going to talk about has to do with feedback, which has become a bit of a buzzword, particularly for studying things going on at high redshift, where energetic events were a lot more common than they are today, and which is invoked in lots of different ways, some of which might be correct and others are definitely wrong, are invoked to solve all the problems that in forming galaxies. So I should say, too, that almost everything that I'm going to talk about today is in collaboration with most of these people, including two current Caltech graduate students. So here's a picture that dates back to the late 1970s or so, roughly, about, and this is the sort of picture of how a galaxy forms. You have a dark matter halo, you have hot gas in the halo, and you have cooling, which is easy to calculate from some virial temperature, and you can calculate the cooling rate, and you work out that any gas that's capable of cooling on a short time scale forms stars, and therefore you get some kind of star formation recipe. And one of the predictions, of course, is that you keep making a little disk from the infalling gas that's available for star formation, and then maybe that disk runs into something else and becomes something that doesn't look like a disk anymore. But it's fairly clear that this picture is not correct, really not even close to correct in describing what's really happening at high redshifts. And there's lots of evidence, which I won't go into in much detail. But one of the things, of course, that we all know about hierarchical structure formation is that it's a bottom-up formation of structure where you have small things becoming larger things with time. And so an obvious supposition might be that you start to, if you look at high redshift galaxies, they're small, and the largest star-forming objects in the universe, the youngest galaxies would be the largest because they're the ones that form the latest. And when you actually look at the real universe, and we've known this for a really long time, even before we could look at galaxies that were distant, we've known it from the fossil record, but it looks a lot more like an anti-hierarchical picture in which the largest galaxies finish earliest, and that the galaxies that are still doing their thing today are among the smallest.
Yeah. Chuck, but I thought when you look at, you know, like the Hubble Ultra Deep Field, you see a lot of very small galaxies.
Right.
So at least in some cases, yeah, you are getting the standard picture where they're small then and then they get larger.
Well, you definitely see small galaxies, and even the massive galaxies are small. Mm-hmm. When I say big, I mean big by mass.
Oh, okay.
And yes, there are still lots of small things too. They're just the conundrum is just how early the biggest things seem to form. And it all comes down to understanding how you get lots of gas in one place on a very short time scale and turn it into stars. I don't think we really understand how that works yet. There are some interesting ideas floating around these days. There's also lots of interest in trying to understand what the relationship is between black holes and or supermassive black hole growth and galaxy formation. It's very clear that it's a some kind of connection. We know it's a symbiotic relationship, but we don't know really which is driving which. We don't know very clearly whether the black hole influences the galaxy it sits in or whether the galaxy and the black hole grow together and die together in terms of their activity. It's not really clear, and I'm not going to talk about it much today because this is mostly star formation interested people, but there's a large community invoking AGN to solve a lot of the problems associated with understanding why galaxy formation doesn't work the way you might naively predict. it's got its problems, and that's all I'll say about it right now. We can talk about it later if anybody wants to. What is the relationship between the huge reservoir of gas that's out at in the intergalactic medium? Something like 90% of the baryons are in the IGM at redshifts of 3 or so. So almost all the stuff is outside of galaxies, and of course this is a potential source of fuel for any growth in the galaxies and star formation in the galaxies. And the question is, which way is the net flow of gas? Is it out or in, or some of both? And we'd like to understand how that works. What drives galaxy-scale star formation? You know, whenever you see, and I'll talk about this later, if you look at images of distant galaxies, they all look like train wrecks. They all look messed up. But the problem is there's absolutely no way that there are enough mergers to explain them all as mergers. And so the point really is that I think you would call things non-equilibrium configurations, which are not necessarily due to merging things of comparable mass together, but for whatever reason, that's what they look like. we'd like to know, once you turn on stars and let supernovae explode and you have energy production by from the accretion process, how does that affect the subsequent star formation, the subsequent growth of the galaxy, and what can we learn about you know, what influences it might have on the nearby environment where the galaxies are forming, and that sort of relates into this last bullet here. So there are lots of questions, and there are lots of problems. Too few small galaxies relative to expectations, too few really big galaxies relative to expectations, disks that are predicted to be, in simulations, the disks are always more compact than real disks, and there are lots of problems, and they all have to do with, or most of them have to do with understanding what's going on with the baryons. And I think it's safe to say that a lot of this is not well understood, at least not on all the scales that are relevant to the problem. So why bother with high redshift when everything is harder from an observational standpoint? it's a good question. One of the reasons is because you can. It's just kind of exciting to be able to sort of observe things as they're happening. But it's really because there's a period in the universe that you might call the bright ages, or the time when everything was reaching a sort of peak for a combination of reasons. It's a combination of availability of big dark matter halos and lots of gas that hasn't been turned into stars yet, and that combination makes that the peak of the star formation history of the universe. And it looks like about half of all the stars in present-day galaxies formed in this little couple billion year interval of time that corresponds to these redshifts, between about 3.5 and 1.5. And the really nice thing is that also happens to be a range over which you can study the diffuse intergalactic medium with quite a bit of dynamic range using quasars and other sources, and I'll talk about that today. So this interface between galaxies and the intergalactic medium, it's something that's really hard to take advantage of in the local universe simply because we haven't had a large UV telescope. Once you get beyond a redshift of 1.5 or 1.6 or so, you have access via ground-based astronomy to understanding what's going on with the diffuse gas in the intergalactic medium, and you can study this interface is a very useful place for measuring things fairly precisely, energetic things that are going on in galaxies. Sometimes it's the case that you get better measurements for this diffuse gas that's right next to a galaxy than you do for looking at the galaxy itself, and this is simply a sensitivity issue. And because as you go to fainter and fainter potential background sources for studying this stuff, I would argue that it's possible to do quasi-tomography of the intergalactic medium and study the galaxies and the IGM in the same volumes at the same time, and we've been trying to do that for about the last 6 or 7 years, and I'll talk a little bit about the most recent results today. So the observational goal of all this is first to understand something about how cooling of gas and star formation behaves in these high redshift objects. How does the feedback processes affect the individual galaxies during this exciting period of time? The effects on everything else in the environment via radiation, via moving gas around, input of energy, etc. And basically just trying to observe all of the baryons that might be relevant to how galaxies are forming rather than just the ones that have settled into to galaxies, and trying to take account of the circulation of baryonic material in and out of galaxies during this time. So a little bit of sort of zoology about galaxies at high redshifts. There are lots and lots of acronyms about things that are selected in different ways, which I think are irrelevant for the present purposes. Almost everything that we know about it at these kinds of distances are what would be considered very, very luminous objects in the present day universe. So most of the things that we know about, at least spectroscopically, would be called luminous infrared galaxies or above if they were in the local universe. And in fact, you can find things with a huge range in stellar mass that have about the same range in bolometric luminosity. And this is because you actually find galaxies that are just starting out turning their gas into stars, and galaxies that are just about finished. And they sort of magically produce about the same star formation rates in the process. And like the local universe, there's a relationship between the overall bolometric luminosity from star formation and how extinguished, what the ratio is between the infrared and the far ultraviolet, a measure of overall opacity of dust from dust where the stars are forming. And it's the case that the lowest luminosity things are quite transparent. Most of the energy comes out in the UV, and the very highest luminosity things are very far from being transparent, and most of the energy comes out in the far infrared. The things that I'm going to talk about primarily are the things in here, because they have a high space density, roughly that of L-star galaxies today. And so they're very common. So they're kind of what you would call run-of-the-mill objects at these redshifts. They're not extreme by any stretch. So you can think of them, if you want, as sort of typical objects at redshifts of 2 or 3 or 4 with bolometric luminosities are in the lurg to ulurg range. And we have crude measures of star formation rates, and there are lots of ways to do it. None of them works particularly well, but they all give you about the same answer to within a factor of 2 or 3. And all of these have been used, and this is more or less what you get, this relationship here. So what do you do with these things? Well, one of the nice things about getting to high redshift is that you have access to spectral regions that are otherwise pretty hard to do from the ground. And one of them is the far ultraviolet, where there's a huge amount of astrophysical information if the galaxy has any light there coming out, and B, if it's bright enough to get a decent spectrum. And these are spectra taken of the same objects that all happen to be at redshifts of 2 or 3. In the far ultraviolet, that is the observed frame optical, and in the familiar rest wavelength around H alpha with a near infrared spectrometer in the atmospheric K band near 2 microns. And you can learn different things about the galaxies by looking at these different kinds of information. From these optical spectra, you learn something about the high mass end of the initial mass function just by looking at the integrated stellar light. You learn about photospheric abundances. You learn about interstellar medium metallicity, because most of these lines are actually produced by interstellar gas associated with the galaxy, and kinematics of the interstellar medium, and I'll talk quite a bit about that. And from these near-infrared spectra, you learn about dynamical masses, kinematics, ionized gas metallicity, crude star formation rate estimates from lines like H-alpha. We don't have, generally speaking, for most things at high redshift, we don't have bolometric measures of luminosity. We have monochromatic things that you use some relationship to estimate a bolometric luminosity based on what you know about other things. So it's a bit circular, but it can't be wrong by too much, because all of the different indicators give you roughly the same answer. So I'll come back to some of this. So one of the things that you can do with these H-alpha spectra is get crude measures of metallicity. And this is a surprising result that came out of a survey of about 100 of these galaxies getting H-alpha spectra. And this is just the metallicity in the H2 regions on these funny units that I don't know why people use them. 12 plus log over O over H, where solar is this relationship right here. This cloud is the Sloan Digital Sky Survey result. And this result here, this is stellar mass and metallicity. And you can see that the overall shape of the metallicity relationship with respect to stellar mass is similar to what it is at low redshift. But the normalization is different by about a factor of 3 or so. And you know, most people interpret this kind of relationship saying, well, this is because low mass galaxies are not capable of retaining the products of their own stars, because their potential wells are small, whereas high mass galaxies can keep most of their metals, and therefore the metallicity. It turns out not to be anywhere near as simple as that, and probably that isn't the right explanation. If you look at this in detail, it turns out that these galaxies are actually retaining just as much of their ISM as the ones up here. And this just has to do with the fact that the gas fractions are many times higher in these objects at high redshift than anything that appears in the plot for low redshift. There's no relationship between metallicity and luminosity.
So you mean that a closed box model will work, or you still need the info to understand?
No, a closed box model will not work. It fails quite badly.
But you need more info than outflow, you mean?
No, you can do it with lots of outflow and no infall.
Oh, I see.
But then you get things that don't quite make sense in terms of time scales. I wasn't going to talk too much about that, but the best model is one where you're moving gas out at a roughly the same rate that it's coming in.
May I comment? Actually, we saw in a paper that has been posted recently, that you can actually explain the trend with pure info, no outflow whatsoever, as long as you take into account the fact that smaller galaxies lie below or at a critical star formation threshold, where the star formation becomes very inefficient. So essentially, instead of just blowing out the metals, you just don't make as much.
I think that could be true if you took this piece of evidence in isolation, but I think if you take it with everything else we know about the galaxies, I'm not sure.
No, actually, this we have a combination of a semi-analytic model, mm-hmm, that describes this physics I just explained, but it is also true. It has been we also looked at simulations,
right,
using the ARC code from Trey Crafter, and it turns out that there is no difference, including or not feedback. So.
Yeah, I'm not surprised that there are no unique solutions to this, and I think that this is a piece of a complicated puzzle for sure. And I'd like to talk to you some more about
these
that.
These are both star-forming populations.
One. That's right.
Zero, one,
yeah, they probably aren't the descendants of these are probably not those.
Right, that's what I was
saying. So in some ways, this is actually reflecting something about the way star formation in galaxies works and not necessarily showing you an evolutionary pattern for the same objects. One thing that I think is really interesting is looking, it's possible, now this is the kind of thing that makes people really cringe a little bit, but you can turn an H-alpha surface brightness into a gas mass, because we can't measure gas mass until ALMA comes along any other way, using an inversion of the Kennicott-Schmidt law. And it actually turns out not to be a totally stupid thing, and I'll show you some evidence that that's the case. But if you do that, and then you ask, well, what is the fraction by mass, that is gas mass divided by gas mass plus stellar mass, where the stellar mass is estimated using the near-infrared photometry. So they're independent measurements. And the answer is that the lower mass things in the sample have inferred gas fractions that can be as high as about 90%. So these things are almost entirely cold gas in the region that we're looking at. And things that are becoming quite mature galaxies, big galaxies, are just about to run out of gas, if you believe this. And it's also the case that it's right around in here where you start to see obvious AGN stuff going on, right about the time these things are running out of gas.
When you say you invert based on the Kennicott-Schmidt relation, there are two forms which I wouldn't necessarily expect to agree for your galaxies. Which one are you using and why?
Which one am I using and why? We're using the same one that Rob used to produce. We're basically just taking the gas surface density and relating it to the H alpha surface brightness.
So you're using the one sigma g to the 1.4, not sigma over omega.
That's right.
Or not sigma times omega. Okay.
Yeah, that's right.
And what was the AGN stuff that you saw coming out?
Yeah, so these are the kinds of AGN that you wouldn't notice unless you looked hard. Like you see an upturn in the at 8 microns in the Spitzer data that clearly look non-thermal, or you see a broad component to the H alpha line and you didn't recognize anything from the far ultraviolet spectrum. So these are sort of subtle AGN signatures. They're not quasar-like things.
But they're very common.
Yeah. About 30 or 40% of things down here are hard X-ray sources in the deepest Chandra images. So the AGN activity is a very common thing, whereas it's quite uncommon for these things, or at least at a detectable level is uncommon. Now, these objects that I was just showing you are selected in a particular way, actually, based on their far ultraviolet colors. But if you take everything that we know about at similar redshift and you put them on a plot, essentially that gas fraction is more or less equivalent to a star formation rate divided by existing stellar mass, a specific star formation rate. And the same trend is present where you have low mass objects that are forming stars much higher than they ever did in the past, and the highest mass objects are very showing evidence that either they're extremely long lived, like the age of the universe, or the current star formation rate is much smaller than it used to be. It's not surprising or anything. It's just that you see these trends with stellar mass, no matter how you slice up the various zoos at high redshift. Now I was saying how there is some evidence that this inversion of the Kennicott relation works to zeroth order. And this is one piece of evidence. If you plot a dynamically inferred mass from an H-alpha line width against inferred stellar mass from the photometry, you get kind of a scatter plot against each other. whereas if you then add in the inferred mass of gas from the H-alpha surface brightness, you get this relation here, which is much better, as you can see. And in fact, even these things that have very, very large dynamical masses compared to their stellar masses don't behave too badly when you include the gas. So, you know, I wouldn't recommend this if you have other alternatives, but it might not be so crazy to estimate them that way. So I don't have time to go through the details of where these things come from, but you'll have to take my word for it at some level. A typical galaxy that I'm talking about lives in a dark matter halo of mass a few times 10 to the 11 to around 10 to the 12, so not too different from the Milky Way halo today. It's about half stars and half gas on average in the inner few kiloparsecs, and one of these things is typically a few times 10 to the 10 solar masses of each. So they're big, you know, they're massive things. But that gas that's in
sorry, this is based on the halo size, not on the, so, on the inversion of the Kennecott.
No, this is based on a measurement of the stellar mass from doing a fit to the photometry, to broadband photometry. So it's the standard way of estimating stellar masses. And the inferred gas mass from the H-alpha surface brightness. So there are two number.
What is based on that? It is not. But how does that compare with the baryon mass of that halo?
Well, this is what I'm saying in this next bullet.
Oh, sorry.
It accounts for more than 50% of the baryons that this halo has any right to in the inner few kiloparsecs. And so it's very clear that cooling, however it happened, has been extremely efficient. And it's almost like a galaxy receives an entire supply of baryons and then works its way through that pile over a few hundred million years. It doesn't make any sense, of course, but that's what the observations say.
And, so could you compare these numbers with the Milky Way
data set? Milky Way is what, about 5%? Gas mass is about 5% of the total.
Yeah, but I'm particularly interested when you add them all, like, how are we doing on our total?
Oh, yeah.
Baryons, particularly in the
somewhere between in the inner few kiloparsecs, yeah, so that's about 10 to the 11 solar masses. It's much denser, I think, than, well, the bulge might, if the Milky Way bulge were larger, it might not be too far off.
Yeah, but our bulge is not that big.
Right, that's right. I mean, you know, the obvious inference is that this is, you know, these are sort of spheroidal components of galaxies, but, you know, I think, I tend not to say anything about that because it gets people excited and jumping up and down, and I don't really know that's the case, but the scales are about right. What I'm going to show now is that almost everything that we can observe is probably losing more gas than it's forming into stars, and this is not—it's really not too much different from the kind of thing that Crystal Martin works on for nearby galaxies. You see, it's just that everything is moving gas out. Everything that we can observe at high redshift is doing it. So it's not just starburst galaxies as opposed to regular galaxies. Everything looks like an extreme starburst at high redshifts. One of the things that we've been able to do very recently is dissect these things on small angular scales using the Keck Laser Guide Star Adaptive Optics System. And this is work that David Law is doing for his thesis. And it's really hard. It's very hard to do this stuff. But here we've got sort of slightly better than HST resolution. It's about 700 or 800 kiloparsecs at the resolution at the redshift of these things. So it's not anything to write home about by the standards of nearby galaxies, but by the standards of distant ones it is. And these boxes are all 3/4 of an arc second in total size. And you can see that all three of these are compact. And you can also see that this is just the velocity, the centroid velocity for each pixel. And what this is an H-alpha emission line map. And you should look at it just like you would look at a radio map or a 21-centimeter map or something, or an H-alpha map of a nearby galaxy. And you can see that there isn't any real obvious shear across this whole galaxy here. It's only about 20 or 30 kilometers per second dispersion in the centroid velocity of those pixels. It's got fairly high velocity dispersion, around 100 kilometers per second, if you look at the velocity dispersion of every pixel. So you see everything from something that looks almost like dispersion-dominated kinematics to things where you definitely have a shear component. This is at a redshift of 3.3. And it's only a few tenths of an arc second across, and you can see that it's got shear of about plus or minus 70 kilometers per second or so. But it's still the case that the velocity dispersion at every point is 70 or 80 or 90 kilometers per second. So these are not like disks in the present day universe, even if they have a shear component, which I'd say is in the minority, they're what you might call dispersion dominated. So they're messy things. I'm not saying that these are equilibrium things. They're just things where the velocity field is chaotic enough that they don't look like disks, in spite of what you might expect.
So what sample of galaxies are you doing?
This happens to be the UV arrest.
Like the Lyman break galaxies?
These are like effectively Lyman break galaxies. Yeah, they're.
So then you're saying that's typical. Lyman break galaxies generally are dispersion dominated.
That's been what we've observed so far. Mm-hmm. Some of them, I mean, some of the ones I know that Reinhard Genzel was here, and we collaborated with them, and we gave them some of our sample. To observe, and what happened was we knew some of them were the most unusual, most massive, and had already knew that they had shear even from the seeing limited data. It's not clear to what extent all of these differences are differences in selection, but I would say that the typical galaxies are more like this than like these big blobby things with some ordered rotation. So this is just that one again, and this is just the star formation surface density is about 25 solar masses per year per square kiloparsec, which is, you know, many orders of magnitude times what you need to drive a wind from these things. These are very dense, compact, with lots of energy. Yes.
Could you say that these objects look like in a regular dwarf galaxy today, or regular galaxies, or are they yet different?
Well, I mean, they're just a whole lot more massive and brighter than a dwarf galaxy. I mean, these are sort of an L-star galaxy's worth of stuff collected in the size of a dwarf galaxy. So in that sense, they're not too different from a nearby starburst galaxy in terms of what they look like, I think. They're just scaled up in terms of their size. The other thing, it's a galaxy with a velocity dispersion of about 100 or so, but then if you look at the far ultraviolet spectrum, which is this, the interstellar lines, which are blue shifted, are going out up to 1,000 kilometers per second. So this thing, it's compact, it's producing lots of energy, and there's stuff coming out at 1,000 kilometers per second, which, you know, is a lot bigger than the escape velocity of this. Particular
here.
There is no evidence of AGN, and we've looked very hard in this particular case. We don't see any unresolved point source in the AO observation, and that's a good spectrum. There's no sign of AGN lines in that or in the infrared spectrum. It's all clean.
How much gas is coming out of this velocity?
That is very difficult to estimate, and Crystal could tell you a lot about this, but the problem is you don't know where it is. And I'm going to spend the rest of my talk trying to figure out where it is. Where is the gas and how far does it get? This is just that one that appears to look kind of like it's rotating. This is the best model one can come up with, the best disk model, which gets the amount of shear, but it just doesn't look quite right. And if you look in detail, I don't think you should take seriously this turnover because I don't think it's significant. This is what these things typically look like. You don't see rotation curves, you just see shear profiles. And it's still the case that the velocity dispersion is greater than the rotational velocity at every point. And I think if you'd like to see what more of these things look like, these are all things with spectroscopic redshifts between 2 and 3 or so, and you can see that they come in all shapes and sizes. And the thing I like to say about morphology is you can see anything you want. And it turns out that the structure of these things bears absolutely no relation to any other thing that you can measure about them. Some of them are modified by extinction. These are all rest frame far ultraviolet, or rest frame ultraviolet at least. Some of them look the same at all wavelengths. Some of them don't. But you know, you can't really tell anything about them. I mean, just because you have two lumps here does not make a merger. If you look at you can look at the velocity field of this, and you can see that it's not merger-like. So it's very misleading to think that galaxies, I mean, that everything's a merger.
And so what rest frame then?
This is, let's see, it's probably about 2,000 angstroms in the rest frame.
How do you get that morphology without a merger?
Well, you can just have an unstable configuration of, you know, where you accreted lots of, you're basically looking at the H2 regions here. I mean, it depends on what you call a merger, too. I mean, most people have in mind when they think merger of two things of roughly equal mass doing a dance together. And, you know, the accretion is happening all the time, we're told. Mergers are... I mean, these things have L-star space densities. They can't all be mergers of in that sense, of in the usual sense of the word. So this is just a comparison of HST, ACS images and some H-alpha images taken with adaptive optics, just to show that, you know, some things do look the same in H-alpha and in the far ultraviolet. There are other things that are more extinguished that would look quite different. But what I want to focus on now is what you can learn from the far ultraviolet spectra, which is quite rich. And the really nice thing about these things is that things with high star formation rates are not nearly as extinguished in the high redshift universe as they are now. And so there's a lot more light coming out per unit bolometric luminosity in the far ultraviolet, which means you can get really nice spectra. This is a stacked spectrum of about 100 objects, and you can see Lyman alpha emission and a bunch of interstellar absorption lines. And the thing that I want to talk about is that this is a lensed galaxy with a higher quality spectrum, and what you're looking at is different transitions of various ions of many different ionization stages. And you can see this is the rest frame velocity at zero, and you can see there's an envelope going from zero out to about 1,000 kilometers per second or so. And this turns out to be a generic feature of these high redshift objects, even though typically we get spectra that aren't nearly as good. When we stack up a whole bunch of spectra, you get the same kind of profile that goes out to about 1,000 kilometers per second. This particular sample has much stronger Lyman alpha emission. And you also notice that that Lyman alpha emission is significantly redshifted with respect to the zero. And this is another generic property. And the usual interpretation is that you're seeing an outflow, and you're seeing scattering off the backside in emission. You're seeing the foreground stuff in absorption. And it works pretty well. And in fact, a model that works best to explain what's observed is a more or less spherically symmetric outflow. With Lyman alpha varies by quite a bit, and it's subject to the vagaries of how much stuff is at zero velocity roughly. So it's goes all over the place, from being completely in absorption, a damped Lyman alpha profile, to being very strongly in emission. But it's almost never at the right redshift. It's one of the problems, actually, is that you can get beautiful spectra and not any of those lines are at the redshift of the galaxy. They're all different by a few hundred kilometers per second. You actually need H-alpha to pin down the systemic redshift. So this is just what it looks like if you bin up a sample and you ask, what is the average velocity of the centroids of the absorption lines, and what is the average velocity of the centroids of Lyman alpha? The typical widths of these absorption lines are about 700 kilometers per second or so. So they're very different from typical intervening quasar absorption line systems, which are usually more like 50 to 100 kilometers per second. These are really strong because you're looking right down the barrel of something, and you're seeing a range of velocities that goes all the way from zero to 700-900 kilometers per second. These are three objects stacked on top of one another, all lensed so that they're much brighter than typical, with a resolution of about 6,000 or so. And you can see that they all share this kind of interesting envelope. Even though the details are different, they all look, you know, similar. And they all reach a sort of similar maximum velocity. Again, many, many times, probably at least twice as high the escape velocity of any of those halos would be.
Is there a scaling with the escape velocity, or the escape velocity is such a narrow range that you can't...
Certainly, that's what crystals see some evidence for, a trend with escape velocity. I think the problem is that the range is too narrow within our sample. Mm-hmm. We don't see any trends. The only trend we see in the kinematics of the outflowing gas is with total baryonic mass, cold gas plus stars. We also see a trend with dynamically inferred mass, but it's not quite as strong as that from the baryonic mass. And the trend looks like this. If you look at the spectra, if you take high mass things, these are things that with baryonic masses of greater than 5 times 10 to the 10 versus less than 5 times 10 to the 10, you can see that the low mass objects have stronger Lyman alpha emission. This is probably mostly a dust effect. You can also see that, on the other hand, the profiles are otherwise similar. They're just, this one's attenuated. But the interstellar lines, they reach the same maximum velocity, but you can see that the high baryonic mass objects have an envelope at lower velocity, which is interesting. So they have the same outflow terminal velocity, but they have much more stuff close to the systemic velocity. And if you look at the details of that, you find that that component, the difference between the two, is a component that's sitting in a place where it could actually be seeing a signature of infall, which is hard to see in general. And the theorists tell us, the people who work on simulations tell us, that the reason you never see a signature of infall is because the covering fraction, or the number of steradians over which infalling gas is flowing, is much smaller than that over which the outflows go, which is probably about 4 pi steradians. And so the chance of seeing that inflowing filament is small. I don't know if I believe that necessarily, but it could be that we're seeing evidence for infalling stuff in higher mass objects. So we now know that more or less everything that we can observe has an outflow. So the question now is, can you tell how far it gets? Can you tell how much stuff is involved? And can you tell whether it actually affects the environment in its neighborhood? And the reason we want to know the answer to that is because we want to know how lossy are galaxies, how much gas are they actually losing. But we also want to know how the physics of the surrounding medium are being perturbed by the energetic activities that are going on in the middle. And so what we've been trying to do is densely sample the high redshift universe, where instead of just looking at the spectra of individual galaxies, you sort of look at the whole thing as an ensemble. And you stick a bright, nice bright quasar in the middle, because you might as well get some nice data along with all the sort of lower signal-to-noise information you get from the galaxies. So we have one sort of core sample and lots of opportunities to look at, say, the gas associated with this galaxy in the spectrum of that object, the gas associated with this object in the spectrum of the quasar, and you kind of try to put it all together and make a picture in three dimensions about what's going on in the vicinity of the galaxies and the quasars. So this is boring probably if you're a theorist, but you know, we've been trying to, the last 2 or 3 years, we've been trying to really hammer on this. And what we did is we chose the 11 brightest quasars in the sky in the northern hemisphere, more or less, in a particular range of redshifts, simply because those are the ones that allow you to get extremely good high-resolution spectra with a Schell spectrometer. And what we do is we fine-tune our selection criteria to zero in on this redshift range, and we have lots of galaxy spectra, about 1,500 or so, and we're sampling it at a high enough density that the incidence of pairs, of unrelated pairs, is quite high, and so you can start playing this tomography game a little bit. We're looking at quasar environments and various things associated with the quasar, which I won't talk about today for lack of time. But what we're really trying to do is look at the impact, look at the IGM content and the IGM physics in the vicinity of the galaxies in a statistical way. And so I'll show you some results from that. So this is just an example. This is about 7 arc minute by 5 arc minute region centered on this quasar, and everything that has a circle has a spectroscopic redshift. The things that are marked in blue are foreground to the quasar. Things that are marked in red are at the same redshift of the as the quasar, and the things that are marked in green are behind it. We're trying to do other things here. We're trying to look at the effects of the radiation from the quasar on the Lyman Alpha forest along the lines of sight to background galaxies, but I don't have any results to tell you about today on those. I'm going to tell you instead about the galaxy-galaxy stuff. This is a redshift histogram in this field, and you can see that there's this big spike at a redshift of 2.84, and that actually is the redshift of the quasar. And it turns out that this quasar lives in a very overdense region. It's not what you would call a cluster. It's what you would call a protocluster of galaxies. And a brief aside, and people who were at lunch today, I showed this. I mean, I mentioned something about this. And this is the same. The reason I'm mentioning it now is because in that same field, we've gotten an extremely deep Lyman Alpha image centered on the redshift of the quasar in this protocluster. And this is just a continuum image. And I'm just going to blink a few times. And what you'll notice is that that dark stuff, just don't pay attention to the white things, just look at the black. You can see that there's this diffuse Lyman Alpha all over the place. There are about 100 of these little blobs in a very small field. And this one here, little blob here, actually has been studied, and it looked like it was completely consistent with simply reprocessing the UV ionizing radiation from this quasar and turning it into Lyman Alpha and sending it our way. And when we got this image, we looked at how dinky the little one we already knew about was compared to everything else. This is about 20 arc seconds across, this one over here. And so there's not too much doubt that this quasar is influencing its environment. And this is just, we got some spectra of a bunch of these blobs, and this is just the histogram of redshifts. And it's exactly centered on the redshift of the quasar, it turns out. And some of them have these peculiar double profiles, which is remarkably similar to what a naive prediction of what the emergent spectrum would look like from a fluorescing object, although it doesn't prove anything. So that's all I'm going to say about that right now. So more to the point, what we've got instead is here's the quasar line of sight, and here's one of the galaxies in the sample. Here's the spectrum of the galaxy. You can see that it's noisy, but perfectly adequate. This is the high-resolution spectrum shifted to the rest frame of that foreground galaxy. So we learn about H1, oxygen-6, carbon-4, silicon-4, silicon-2, and you know about 100 other ions that are accessible in the spectrum. So we're learning about the details of the physics of the gas that's, in this case, 85 kiloparsecs away from the galaxy. Now, the reason oxygen-6 is particularly important, and we designed the whole survey to focus on accessibility of that, is it more or less is the kind of a smoking gun for gas that's been recently disturbed. If you see carbon-4, that might have been sitting around for gigayears. But if you see oxygen-6, it means it's gas at an interface between cool gas and hot gas, or gas that's cooling down from higher temperatures, which is the kind of signature from the effects of winds that one might hope to find. I'll skip that for now. So more difficult and less information-packed are the spectra of galaxies. Here's a pair of galaxies that are a couple of arc seconds apart. Here's a two-dimensional spectrum, sort of raw spectrum where wavelength goes this way and spatial separation goes this way. And the one's at a redshift of 2.2, and the other's at a redshift of 1.6. So what we're seeing is something like, whoops, this diagram here, where you're seeing material that presumably is flowing out from this galaxy against the continuum of this galaxy. So you're getting a measure that's about 15 kiloparsecs out of both the kinematics and mostly of the kinematics of the gas as it's flowing out. And you can do this for lots and lots of pairs, because there are hundreds of them on relevant separations. So this is the spectra of just these two things. And what you're seeing here is that whereas the spectrum of the gas in this object is blue shifted. That's the red line. You can see it's blue shifted by a couple hundred kilometers per second net. The spectrum against the background source is at zero, is at systemic redshift of the foreground galaxy, and which I thought was kind of cool because it more or less says that the gas that you're seeing in absorption is associated with that object and just it isn't just hanging around and happened to be in the general vicinity. And this turns out to be the case when you look at a much larger sample and you stack a whole bunch of pairs of galaxies together. And these are composite spectra based on these stacks. So this is a stack of all of the foreground galaxies stacked in their rest frame. So you're basically looking down the barrel, right down into the center of the galaxy, and you're seeing the outflowing interstellar material. And then you move to pairs that are between 1 and 5 arc seconds, which is the typical distance of 30 kiloparsecs. So you're getting two views through the same material. You're getting one down the barrel, and you're getting one out 30 kiloparsecs or so. And you can do the same game and look at gas out at larger distances by choosing ensembles of pairs that are slightly larger. And it turns out that these lines remain very, very strong, particularly carbon-4 out to 100 kiloparsecs or so. And if you look at their velocities, it's just like the case that I showed earlier where the gas associated with foreground objects are very wide. The lines are wide, but they're systematically set at about, I mean, their centroids are at the systemic redshift of the foreground galaxy. So it's basically consistent with a spherical outflow, just like that cartoon was showing. And there are lots of details I could tell you about this, which would not mean very much. But I think this is the one last thing that I'll talk about is what you get if you take a more statistical approach still, and you, instead of studying quasar absorption lines or studying galaxy spectra, you do something where you take every galaxy that's in one of these quasar fields, and you sit at its in the rest frame, and then you ask, well, what in the spectrum of this quasar, what is the optical depth in some transition? So that I'm basically getting an ensemble of different distances from the galaxy, both along the line of sight and transverse to the line of sight, just by looking at different pixels in the quasar spectrum. So you sit on 800 different galaxies in 12 different fields, and you can get a map as a function of distance from the galaxy of what the H1 optical depth is on average. So this is averaged over directions. This is the typical profile in H1 with respect to an average place in the universe near a galaxy. And this is the same thing for carbon-4. So you can see that both of them show a significant excess near the galaxies, which isn't surprising. But carbon-4, the excess is more concentrated on scales less than about 1 co-moving megaparsec, which is about 200 or 300 proper kiloparsecs at these redshifts, and that turns out to be an interesting length scale. If you then look at this, now let me skip that. If you then look at this in two dimensions, where you're looking at velocity differences along the line of sight, which you can turn into a co-moving spatial distance if you assume that it's pure Hubble flow. So you divide this number by 100, and you get the same units that you have along here. And you can see that the H1 is quite symmetric about zero. In other words, they're not, the net peculiar velocities are low. So the H1 is more or less at rest with respect to the galaxies. You don't see a very significant finger of God elongation along the line of sight, whereas you do see that for carbon-4. And you also see that it's concentrated on scales. That finger of God is concentrated on scales less than about 1 megaparsec or a couple, 200 or 300 kiloparsec proper length scales. And it becomes even more extreme if you look at oxygen-6, where they're about 600 or 700 kilometers per second of peculiar velocity along the line of sight, where and all confined to distances within 200 or 300 kiloparsecs. So what you're actually seeing is the smoking gun from gas that's moving at very high velocity, and the velocities get higher as you go to higher ionization stages. with respect to the galaxies, and the sphere of influence is up to a 200 or 300 kiloparsecs, so it's large compared to the size of the galaxies. And the velocities are also large. So that's more or less just looking at all three at the same time.
Is the width different between the O6 and the carbon 4?
The width?
The transverse distance?
No, it's pretty much the same. It's a bit dangerous because these are stretched in order to look at see the contrast, and so they're not all stretched exactly the same way. But it's definitely more significant, the elongation in O6, than it is in carbon 4. There's no question about that. And it's both on this kind of 300 kiloparsec physical scale. And it turns out
spheres for each of these galaxies now starting to approach one another?
No, not.
Still isolated from one another?
They're still pretty isolated, yeah. They're not. I mean, the space density, at least the things we're looking at, is a few times 10 to the minus 3 per cubic megaparsec. So. So I just want to summarize some of the points that I made during this. And it's probably too much stuff to dump in one talk. But the point I really wanted to make is that something is different. You could say that every galaxy looks like a major gas-rich merger, which it does. But it's not plausible to explain them all that way. So most galaxies are more gas-rich than anything in the present universe, except for maybe dwarfy little dwarf galaxies. Star formation efficiency seems to be very high. Gas flows are easy to observe via these absorption line tracers, and generally speaking, you see stuff going out at high velocities that are plenty high enough for things to escape. And as I was just saying, there is evidence that you see high velocity stuff a long way from the galaxies, but where the velocities seem to be emanating from originally from the galaxies that are actually being observed. So the point I really want to make is that even massive things, which are the kind of things that people say, well, nothing escapes from these galaxies, they're almost certainly losing gas in it. And I think to make everything hang together, they have to be losing a lot of gas, probably more than they're turning into stars. So we kind of knew this was happening because we know that there are more metals in the intracluster medium in clusters of galaxies than there are in the stars within the galaxies in the cluster. And that means that the metals had to be put there around the same time that most of the stars were forming, and most of the stars were not forming in small galaxies. They were forming in big galaxies predominantly. So you know that all this stuff had to come from big things. And the reason that it does, and it surprises people, is that the velocities are simply higher than what people usually assume for whatever reason. And I haven't even gone into how these things are produced, but that would be a whole nother discussion. So I think there's all sorts of things you can do with this kind of three-dimensional view, and we're really scratching the surface now, and we're really limited by sensitivity. I mean, this is just really hard with a 10-meter telescope, and we've been jumping up and down for almost 10 years now about what we need to really do it right, which is this. And I've been personally involved in this since it was just a sparkle in Jerry Nelson's eye. It looks like it's becoming more and more real. And this is just some artist. This is an engineering drawing of the telescope, and this is just an artist conception. But this is something that will make this kind of 3D study of the high redshift universe quite easy to do, and with a huge amount of information of the type that I was talking about today, but of much higher fidelity. Thank you.
Rates that are inferred from the data anywhere near just these really, as you mentioned earlier, simple line pictures, how gas cools, simplest theory point of view.
The theorists are now saying that the gas in most of these galaxies never gets shock heated to the virial temperature in the first place. It just goes directly in, doesn't stop. The exact reasons for that I haven't completely understood, and the exact reasons why this is new I haven't completely understood. But it's one of these things, my impression, and we had a whole day of at a meeting recently, a couple weeks ago in Garching, on gas and star formation in galaxies. And it was my impression that there are lots of things in the simulations which people only pay attention to when a problem emerges in the observations. And I think that there's been a lot of, you know, what people are realizing now is that the way they were treating the physics of accreting gas wasn't quite right. And it was making things happen that don't actually happen in nature. And it's a fairly simple fix to make it work. And Simon White gave an interesting talk where he showed that some of the seminal papers from the late 70s actually knew about these issues and had stated them. And then they were promptly forgotten by most of the people since then. But I think the answer is, I think the accretion rate of material typically at redshifts of 2 or 3 is very high, and it's, you know, 20 or 30 solar masses per year for one of these typical 10 to the 12 solar mass halos. So it's not that far off. Again, the problem is that we see evidence for accumulated gas, which means that somehow it sort of got there really fast. It's not like we see stuff keeping pace with the inflow rate. I don't think anyone really completely understands what's going on. Yeah.
Mark? Regarding the inflow, so if it's mostly coming in as sort of cold flows, that means that, you know, it probably occupies a very small volume just because it's dense. You know, it's cold and it's dense, and so what's coming in is more or less cannonballs. Mm-hmm. And so I'm wondering if there are any observational prospects for seeing those cannonballs in any way. You know, is there any technique that might let you find them?
Well, when you say cannonballs, are you talking about you're talking about dense, really dense gas? What are we talking about?
Not really, you know, not really dense by the standards of the local ISM, yeah. But really dense by the standards of, you know, so you see this outgoing stuff, which is, yeah, you know, high ionization,
right,
high temperature. The stuff that's coming in and is cold and is, you know, at temperatures of 1,000 Kelvin instead, yeah, of, you know, 10 to the 5 Kelvin or something.
I think
When people talk about cold flows, usually in the ionized universe, cold means 10 to the 4.
Yeah.
It's not 1,000.
The point is, it's much colder than the stuff that's going out, which is highly ionized and high temperature.
Well, I mean, the interesting stuff about the stuff that's going out is that at every ionization stage is represented, from neutral oxygen up to oxygen 6. And it all has a sort of common envelope, even though it, you know, you can show easily that it can't be arising in the same gas. So it's probably some kind of complicated, messy, multi-phase mixture of stuff where you have cold stuff embedded in hotter stuff, embedded in still hotter stuff, and it's all sort of going out.
But so is it a problem that we don't see, you know, weakly ionized stuff coming in? Or,
well, my explanation is simply that the data aren't good enough in general, and that the it's harder to see inflow simply because the velocities are going to be tiny compared to the outflow velocities. The inflow velocities are going to be a couple hundred kilometers per second max, whereas the outflow velocities are 1,000. And so when you're looking at relatively low resolution spectra, you can't really tell inflowing gas from just a component of gas that's near the systemic redshift of the galaxy. I think that's really what the problem is. And once we get much better spectra of more objects, I think it'll be easier to tell what's going on.
How can we estimate observationally the amount of gas that is outflowing?
Yeah. So the way that people have done this in the past, and we've done it ourselves for one of these gravitationally lensed objects, it's easiest when you have a damped Lyman alpha absorption line produced by the outflow, because then you get an H1 column density, which allows you to have some kind of clue about what kind of column of gas you're looking at. But then you have to make a guess about where it is, because of the mass flux depends very sensitively, obviously, on where that stuff is. And right now, I would say that the high ions tend to be out at tens of kiloparsecs, and the lower ions are spread throughout, you know, 20 or 30 kiloparsecs of distance from the galaxy. And so turning that into a mass flux, I think, is hard. And I think any estimate is going to be sort of wildly uncertain. But if you just do the standard thing, then you get, in the one particular case at high redshift, you get a mass outflow rate roughly equal to the star formation rate, which in that case is 50 solar masses per year or so. It could be more, and it probably that's an underestimate, because you're only seeing the cold gas, and a lot of the stuff is going to be hot that's going out. So, I mean, Crystal can tell you a lot more about what the perspective of the relatively nearby galaxies with better data is.
Now, if you look at the numbers and masses of the objects you're looking at, what kind of objects are they today?
This would not only be a guess. I mean, they're clustering properties, and which allows you to infer something about the halo masses. And then if you follow them in simulations, they end up in sort of relatively massive galaxies in groups and clusters by the present day. If you wanted to make a one-to-one mapping, roughly speaking, to anything with a fairly big spheroid.
But you mentioned, as I recall, they're probably smaller, a few kiloparsecs.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But the galaxies you described are much bigger than that.
Yeah. There's a sort of generic problem out there right now, which is interesting, because, you know, there are objects that are more massive that people have found that using other techniques, which are harder to study because they don't have any ultraviolet flux at all. But if you take the inferences about their stellar masses seriously, then you get matter densities that exceed anything that we know about in the local universe by a factor of 10. So they look like the mass of a giant elliptical in a volume, you know, 10 times smaller. And I don't know what the solution to that problem is. I don't know whether you can rearrange phase space enough by merging these things together to make them look more like the profiles of nearby massive stellar systems or not. Maybe.
What are the prospects for looking at L-star galaxies like the Milky Way at the redshift you're studying now?
Well, I don't think I don't think the Milky Way was an L-star galaxy. I mean, it was if you imagine that what you're seeing is what was equivalent to the formation of the Milky Way bulge, then it would be a relatively small Lyman break galaxy type thing. It would probably still be in the sample. I mean, the typical star formation time scale is about 300 or 400 million years for these things. And what the Milky Way bulge is, what, about 10 to the 10 solar masses and stars? Is that right? Something like that. It would be a relatively faint one. It wouldn't be one of the bigger ones, but it would if it happened at that era, which isn't outrageous to think that it did. The other thing I didn't mention is that you can solve a lot of other problems in principle with getting rid of a lot of low angular momentum material early in the galaxy's life and then having it trickle back in later on to make a disk. You know, you can make disks a lot bigger if you take the low angular momentum stuff, put it out there for a few giga years, and then let it come back in later on. And it's not crazy, because if you actually look at in the simulations, most gas is not gone permanently from the galaxies. You know, it takes a couple giga years, and depending on the environment, could very well come back. And it could be that some of the stuff we see associated with the Milky Way is remnants from this particular era in the Milky Way's history finally coming back.
So actually, one thing I wanted to ask Crystal, to compare results that you're getting in local galaxies with the one that Chuck has, in terms of what the ratio of mass, well, how much mass is going out and how large are the volumes that are filled with the outflows?
The issue of how much mass is going out is really hard to address, because measuring these column densities is hard, because we usually don't have extremely high resolution data except in a few cases. But where we do have high resolution data, I mean, it looks like mass outflow rates are comparable to star formation rates. And a lot of that evidence actually comes in very nearby objects from looking at the X-ray maps and seeing the hot gas out there. So that, I mean, the mass loss rates look similar to what you see at high redshift, except that everything's scaled at high redshift because the galaxies are forming stars at higher rates.
The thing that's easier at high redshift, which is kind of ironic, is just looking at the sort of profile of outflowing material as a function of distance from the galaxies to see how far the stuff gets, because it's just it's hard to get independent sight lines for nearby objects. I know Crystal's working on things associated with that.
You don't really know how big he's out of hundreds of kiloparsecs.
Yeah. So there's been some really nice work on this by the FUSE team in Colorado with oxygen six. Mm-hmm. And in intervening oxygen six systems along a sight line of a quasar, and they're looking at the redshifts of surrounding galaxies. And they get impact parameters of over 200 kiloparsecs to the nearest dwarf galaxies.
Yeah.
So, I mean, these are kind of comparable distances.
Yeah.
I think the other thing where the winds look similar at low and high redshift is in the outflow velocities. If you look at extreme local objects that have star formation rates of 100 solar masses per year, then you see outflow velocities of 400 or 600 kilometers a second. So it's very similar.
Yeah, I think if you look at things with similar bolometric luminosities in the local universe, they look very, very similar. The only difference, I think, is that most things in the local universe are actually a lot more gas poor than the things at high redshift.
Well, they're also dustier.
Dustier.
Yeah, if you have high redshift in the local universe, they're all infrared sources.
That's right. Although, that's right. It's about a factor of 10 difference in dustiness at a given bolometric luminosity between zero redshift and high redshift.
Given that you can peer into these galaxies a bit more than these highly extinguished galaxies of today, can you find any interesting constraints on the IMFs of these?
Well, the spectra themselves, it's interesting. There are some things that are hard to explain about the spectra. They have stronger, for example, stronger helium-2 emission than most of them. I mean, the models, I'm not sure how realistic they are. And it depends on how many Wolf Rayet stars you have and all that kind of thing, which is, but generally speaking, it's completely consistent. Everything that we've looked at in any detail is consistent with a saltpeter-like shape of the IMF at the high mass end. We certainly don't see any evidence for what that people are sometimes invoking about changing the IMF at high redshift compared to low redshift in order to solve other problems. We don't see strong evidence for departure from that kind of a shape.
What about the lower mass cutoff to these starburst models?
We have nothing to say about that. Even photometrically, we don't see things below 5 solar masses. Because the light's all coming from the main sequence stars that are, one of the funny things about a lot of these galaxies, if you look at them at 2 microns in the rest frame, the light is still dominated by O and B stars in these things because they've got so much star formation compared to their past history of star formation.
But can you infer a dynamical mass? My recollection is that when Reinhard was here, he mentioned that, I guess, from getting a dynamical mass, then they could actually infer the total mass in the low mass stars also, which dominate mass.
And I showed how everything works a lot. We do have dynamical mass measurements from H alpha line widths and sizes, and they match very well when you include the stellar mass inferred from the photometry. And this is usually assuming an IMF that is the same one that people think applies in the local universe. So it can't be off by that. And it could be off by a factor of 2 in total stellar mass, but probably not too much more than that. But I'm not sure if you really poked at that argument that it would hold water for very long. Mm. There are a lot of uncertainties in any of those mass estimates. I mean, a lot of them assume some kind of geometrical configuration where you have no evidence that that's actually correct. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of uncertainties that will come out as the data get better, right? You know, the tendency when the data are not so great is to, you know, sweep everything under the rug and try to learn something. But when the data get better, I think we'll find out that things are more complicated.
One of the theoretical epicycles at the moment is aging and feedback.
Yeah.
So do you see any evidence that the outflow property correlated with
that? No. We don't see any evidence that AGN are doing much of anything. But the problem is if the time scales for the AGN activity are very short compared to the time scales for, you know, the star formation episodes, then you could have AGN contributing significantly to this whole game and never know that they're there at all. Because, you know, the stuff that you see out at large distances is stuff that was launched, you know, 100 million years ago. And you just don't, what I would say is that there's no evidence that suggests that AGN do anything, and there's a lot of evidence suggesting that star formation and supernovae do a lot. And so the principle of Occam's razor would suggest that you try to understand how much of what needs to be explained can be explained with what you see. Now the nice thing about AGN is that nobody knows much about how they couple to the interstellar medium of a galaxy. And so you can do almost anything you want just by changing the factor in front of the total energy produced by the AGN. You can make all the gas blown to kingdom come. You can do anything you want to do. And so it's a really great way of making something dramatic happen without having to do anything but put energy in at a point in your system.
But I mean, I think you maybe ruled out more than you think, because the AGN models, as I understand them, are designed to shut off star formation, basically slow everything.
Well, no, okay. Some of the AGN models invoke that kind of a violent end to the galaxy's interstellar medium,
right.
And others just turn them on after everything's finished and just prevent new cold gas from accumulating in the center.
In your case, if you see active star formation and an outflow driven by supernovae, you don't need that.
Right. I keep telling this to people. And the reason that they do AGN is because they're easier, I think. And no one has succeeded in making something that looks realistic in terms of the supernova feedback. And so they tried something else in the meantime. That's what I think is happening. But Chris Lyon.
It's interesting how much can be said at this point about whether the starboard lens can actually turn off star formation. And I think it's interesting that in a lot of these limited bright galaxies, you now have an estimate of how much gas is there from...
whether it's any good or not, yeah.
Yeah. Then, maybe there could be gas at larger radii. Yeah. It's not accounted for in that. But you're getting some measure of how long the gas consumption time for these starbursts. And I'm wondering if... on what time scales they would shut off the gas consumption, and are there galaxies out there that could be there?
Well, I mean, I think it really depends critically on whether the outflows can stop infall. Yeah. And when I ask theorists about this, they're not sure. Because it's not collimated, it doesn't seem to be collimated like nearby starbursts are. It seems to be more or less in every direction that stuff is flowing out. So how do you... and if you have stuff flowing out in every direction, how does stuff come in at the same time? And what happens to it when it meets the outflowing material? I don't have a good feeling for that. If you can halt the if you can stop accretion, then you can finish. You can run through the whole supply of gas. If you can't, then I don't know. It's not obvious how you do it, how you stop star formation, period, whether you have an AGN or... it's not obvious that you, just by having cold gas come in, that you can make the AGN go on just enough to keep it from doing anything before it forms any stars.
Different outflow in every single one, there is kind of outflow.
So yes, that's right.
Essentially, they are coequal coexistent, unless over time, unless you're missing a major component of the galaxy population, but it's probably not the case because there's a lot of...
Yeah, I think that these things are very likely the hosts of the AGN. If I had to guess about when the AGN happened, I think it's near the end of the star-forming lifetime. So things are almost finished when the AGN becomes significant. But I wouldn't say I have any strong, I think that's just my impression. It's not, I can't prove it.
That would correspond to a very strong evolution in the black hole and Sigma relation. Is that right?
Yeah, we tried to look at that. And the problem is you can't measure, you can't really measure black hole masses at these redshifts. I mean, there are some relations that you can use and you can plug in the numbers, and then I just don't believe the numbers that come out. Mm-hmm. But we did do that, and we didn't. Certainly, the clustering of the hosts of the AGN is very similar to that of the galaxies that we're looking at. So that supports the idea that they're sort of one and the same set of objects. But
I was assuming that was the case. But then you're saying that if the black holes form more toward the end, that meant if you looked at
I guess the question is, when does the black hole become noticeable? Mm-hmm. It could be substantially growing and yet be completely dwarfed in a bolometric sense by all the star formation. I mean, one of the things that's interesting is that the bolometric luminosity of the star formation in these things is like the luminosity is right at the borderline between a Seyfert and a quasar in terms of bolometric luminosity. So it's like, you have to have a pretty healthy AGN to even notice that there's anything there. So it could be that it's just this, because of the exponential growth of a black hole, you don't notice it until it's just about finished.
Okay, we're going to have to wind up.
Yeah.
Do you have one more question?
I'm happy to talk to you.
Yeah. Okay, great. Let's thank you.